stage door. There is a guest waiting for you at stage door. Thank you.
What our profession gives us is an incredible change of high to low. You've auditioned for a role that can give you a year's worth of pay, and then you never hear from them again, and the electric bill is due. You're in a theatre as the show you're working on gets a standing ovation, and then it seems the next minute you're sitting alone on a train or a bus or in a hotel room. We all know of stories of colleagues who've had issues with drink or even taken their own lives, and yet there is no investigation of how this industry is structured in terms of aiding its workers. Something that so many of us in this industry will have to deal with is the linking of self-worth with career success, as it deals so much with the personal, the emotions, and a person's physical being. This is perhaps not surprising. A comedian recently said splitting the two was like untangling Christmas lights.
Hello, this is Jackie Clune, and you're listening to the Equity Green Room podcast. And this is sort of part two of our focus on mental health in the industry. It's the second part, and in this edition, I'm going to focus mostly on casting. Stage managers and creatives, of course, also go through a sort of casting process in terms of finding work. But more specifically, I want to look at performers here. We prepare, we research, we smash it, and then silence. Nothing. No, no, thanks. No, it's not you, it's me. No, well done, but it didn't work out this time. Just a big fat void into which our souls slowly disappear. You can be left feeling like you just turned a trick for nothing. Many actors state that this is the cruelest, most mentally damaging feature of being a performer. It's as if we never existed, or that our efforts were not even worth commenting on. There has been a kickback against this in the form of a campaign on Twitter called Yes No, a simple plea for casting directors to let us know either way after an audition so that we're not left wondering if we were even there. And I'm thrilled to say that joining me now in the Equity Green Room is none other than the head of casting at the National Theatre, Alastair Coomer. Welcome, Al.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Very good of you to come on. Now, the National Theatre, Al, under your premiership, if I can call it that, was an early adopter of the Yes No campaign. It must be an incredibly hard job. You're casting lots of people all the time, so many actors coming in and out. And having to get back to them all, I'm sure, can be pretty onerous. Why did you decide it was important to sign up to the Yes No campaign?
Well, I think that some of the stuff that you've touched on already. I mean, we were aware of the impact of it's not so much hearing the no, it's not hearing anything. The impact of that can be really, really debilitating, actually, and is, I think, just disrespectful to the amount of work that, you know, an actor has put into preparing for an audition. I'm very lucky, and I suppose the National has been lucky in that over the last sort of 10, 15 years, it's been the heads of casting, Toby Whale and then Wendy Spon, have both been very, very caring of actors and how they're looked after. And Wendy and Toby sort of trained me up, and the way that we worked was to always go back to actors via their agents or directly if they didn't have an agent, to let them know whether it had happened or not. It wasn't as formalised as it is now, and we have a proper system in place to make sure that we're always doing it. And we have a general email address in case that somebody hasn't heard, so they can just sort of email us and ask us. But when I came back to the National, because I had been at the Donmar Warehouse for 6 years, and they came back as the head of casting 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago. Time has gone a bit weird, as you all know, in the last year and a half. This was on my desk almost immediately, and a group of actors came, I think, really to check in with the NT, to get us on board as a supporter of it. But also some feedback had come in that, you know, there were instances where the National hadn't gone back to people. So we did a bit of a sort of audit of our process, and we reckon we were doing really well. We were really pleased with ourselves. We thought, yeah, we're getting about, I think, 95% of the actors that we see are hearing back from us. But then you think we see about 2,000, 2,500 people in a normal year, pre-pandemic. We auditioned that number of actors, and 5% of 2,500 is, you know, hundreds of people. So when, if you look at it that way, that's just completely unacceptable. So we just made a commitment to ourselves to really improve that. So we just put a system in place, really. I mean, you say it must be very complex. I don't think it is as complex as it is for film and television, where they're doing huge numbers of self-tapes and lots of sort of, it's a much higher volume in the on-screen world for casting. It is a little more straightforward as I say, you know, you have a system by which you get people into audition, so just create a system by which you let them know at the end of it, and once you've set it up, it's there. You know, we've had two new assistants start in the department since then, but they don't know any other way of doing it, and they were surprised when I said that it didn't happen sometimes. Unfortunately, we do know that occasionally people slip through the gap. Either we've messed up and not emailed, or the email's not gone through for any reason, or and I'm afraid to say, quite often we have instances of agents not passing the detail on, and I think that's one of the other things that happens. But we, you know, we really try and do it, and we're trying to be as, you know, as open as possible about the timeline. That's the other most important thing, you know, let people know when they come in for the audition, whether it's going to be a really quick process. You know, we'll know by the end of the week. But sometimes you can say, look, this is the beginning of a very big process. We're putting a whole cast together. It can take 2, 3, 4 weeks. So I think I say quite often to other casting directors, just give people a sense of the timescale.
Give them that dignity of knowing that they're a human being with feelings and hopes and fears, and just be kept in the loop with the information and not treated like a child, I suppose, in a way, isn't it? Is your impression that other casting directors and other institutions are taking this on board? Is this something that casting directors are generally aware of? I mean, most casting directors, it seems to me, like actors. That's why they're in this industry. So they want to treat us well and they want to keep us in the loop. Is that your experience?
I'd say on the whole, I wouldn't say it entirely is. And I think that there's been some quite robust conversations about that. As I say, I can only really speak to my experience in terms of the national and theatre auditions, which is that, you know, I started in a place where I think actually the number of people that were seen for roles 20 years ago was much smaller. And that's an indictment of how the lack of diversity, actually. When I started at the National Theatre, most of the lists that I did for were for men in their 40s and 50s, white men in their 40s and 50s, endlessly. I used to get excited when I did a list of women. And so I do think that, you know, the pool of actors was probably quite a lot smaller. I think if we were able to go back 20 years, it would be much less than 2,500 people being seen by the NT. In those days, it was still the vestiges of the rep system, so there were lots of actors returning. So I do think in theatre we've had to sort of speed up. But most important to me is just be clear about what the process is going to entail. You would have it in any other job, so I don't see why an actor shouldn't know that the decision won't be made for 4 weeks. I mean, you could just. I don't think it's as respectful, but you could put a deadline in place and say, if you've not heard by this point, then the job's not yours. One of the things I thought about, and I have said that, I think casting directors do like actors, but that it is when you're doing a thing very, very regularly, it's really easy to forget what it feels like from their point of view. And you know, I say to my team all the time, remember the day you came in for your interview to work at the National Theatre, how frightening the stage door can feel. The concrete mass of the theatre is not a welcoming building for that, in that regard, you know. So remember that when they're coming into the office to wait, when they're waiting down in the green room, if they're looking for the loo, you've just got to remember that it's on stereo for them, isn't it? It's a really big deal. So just try and remember what that's like. And for me, it was, you know, I had to interview for this job and I was terrified. I was quite surprised by how frightened I was, because, you know, I knew the NT really, really well. And I thought, let me just try and remember, in actor terms, the sense memory of what that feels like, and try and apply that to the people who are coming through. And in the end, if you do that, if you really care for people as they come in, they always, always give a better audition. So we all end up looking great.
So those are tips for your staff and your casting directors. What about tips for actors? You know, it's really interesting talking to directors and casting directors about rejection and about how that impacts on us for any job, backstage, front of house, you know, on stage. What could you say to alleviate that sense of crushing, oh, they hated me? I people often say things like, well, it's just, the chemistry wasn't right or something. What does that actually mean? How can we make ourselves feel better when we're rejected?
Well, to your first point, we genuinely don't never hate anybody. That's just, that doesn't happen. And I do believe that when we set up a session, on some level, we want everybody to get the role. I don't put four people I don't think will get the part and one person I think would. That would be cynical. And we genuinely want to imagine everybody that's coming into audition for that part. But in the end, the maths of auditions is against actors, isn't it? Because in the end, only one person can play it. And I've been thinking a lot recently about the language that we use when we do go back to explain why a thing hasn't happened. And sometimes it is very difficult to explain. If when you're casting musicals quite often, or things that require particular skills, like very particular movement skills, you can really hone in on a detail. You know, they couldn't sing to the range that we needed, that their movement skills weren't as good as the person next to them. But sometimes it is a chemical thing, and it is just very clear on the day, most times who the best person for that role is, through that.
That's
audition.
What I guess makes it so magical when it works for us and so infuriating when it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. Well, I'd like to bring in now Abiola Ogunbiyi, who is on the Women's Committee for Equity and also a wonderful activist. Welcome, Abiola.
Thank you. Thank
Has
you
this
so
been
much.
Chiming with you, any of this?
Yeah, on many, many levels. I think that from my personal experience, but also speaking to peers, I think when you are given a result, it provides a sense of closure, especially if it's a project that you were really invested in and extremely interested in. And I really resonated with what Alistair was saying about the idea of a deadline, because sometimes productions work on different timelines, and even the date that a production is going to happen can be postponed. And I remember a very funny incident where I did a self-tape for a job and didn't hear anything. And then 2 months later, helped a friend with the exact same role.
I've done that too.
That had been rewritten. and I didn't say a single thing. I didn't tell her that I'd read for it. But in my head, I thought, what that actually made me think was, maybe I could tape again. What's to stop that? But if I had received feedback that, it just didn't click, then I could have let it go. And I think that can give actors the ability to release that job and put their energy into the job that they then will get.
You're obviously a lot more optimistic than me, because when that happened to me, I just thought, wow, they still haven't cast this role 2 months later, and they obviously hated me so much they're not even going to come. Like, they're not even going to go, well, at least we've got her. They're going to go again and try.
And it's so, it's one of those, what we do is so, there are so many elements to it that, you can't describe. It is so feeling based. Someone walks in and their energy speaks to the character in the script, and that's enough. And we get that when we get a tape in, you can get three tapes in and say, this is the one. If I had to think which one I could get actually based on my life experience, based on my passion, it would be this one. But I do think that it's such an important issue, because it's very universal. It happens at every single tier of every single tier of actor, and also every single medium through which we work. And it is that for some, it's not knowing, but for others, it's like not being able to move on, because on the flip side, you do have the mental health aspect of hearing every no. You know, if you are doing a lot of tape, if you're having a season of a lot of tapes and hearing no, 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 no. And I think that's a journey that each actor has to have with their rep.
I think also, you know, some people say you should always send your self-tapes on WeTransfer, because it's the only app via which you can see whether it's been downloaded. And I think even maybe watched, because someone once told me that you can send in, they might request 50 self-tapes and only watch three of them. Or, you know, it's not always even the case that doing the tape guarantees you're going to be seen. But what can we do, given that, you know, all of these things are so difficult to navigate and to stay, you've got to stay invested, you've got to stay buoyant, you've got to stay hopeful. You can't be dragging your, you know, desperate carcass into an audition, because that just stinks the room out. You've got to go in and keep like believing that, you know, at one point it is going to be you. How can we do this? Because you've done a lot of work around this, haven't you? Tell me a little bit about To Be a Better Artist.
So To Be a Better Artist was, it initially started as just ideas, like just thoughts about how, as someone is trying to have a long-term sustainable career as an artist in a field where you are putting yourself out there, like what are some practices we can each do to enable us to keep putting ourselves out there? So I do work via posting content on Instagram and also a newsletter that's just asking, getting artists to ask themselves these questions or use science-backed activities and practices to help boost self-esteem and help tackle aspects. And I've done, I feel really grateful that I've been able to work with some psychologists around these issues. And we actually did a workshop with a psychologist called How to Handle Rejection with Effortless Style.
Give us some tips. What can you remember? What are the headlines?
The headlines were that it really is about how we frame it. And we've touched on it here, but I even think the word rejection, it has the word eject in it. It's like literally, you know, what you've done is being sort of sucked out. So if we were talking like actual things that, because I think why this conversation is important is we can see that there are, it's not one route to address this. There are things that people on every level can do. And I do think that if there's any way of creating an automated system, a common code of conduct, so that especially new actors, they know how things are going to go, rather than it differing from company to company, sector to sector, and having to navigate that.
Yeah,
I would say that something that helps me is this feeling of your job is done when you send the work out. So you trust that you've sent it out into the ether, and now it's, you don't let it go when you hear a result, you let it go the moment that tape has reached your agent.
What I do is I rip the sides up and put them straight in the bin. That's very therapeutic.
Have you though had to sellotape them back together?
I think I have.
Definitely.
But I used to get really magical thinking about it. I used to think if I keep them on top of the microwave, I'll get the job. And then that didn't work. So then I thought I'll rip them up, put them in the bin. Mostly that did work, because I never heard anything again. But no, sometimes you do have to take them out and print them again. But it is very important, as you say, your job is to do the tape or to go into the room, audition, and then you walk out and you try. ha-ha, to forget all about it and just leave it up to, you know, that chemistry, elusive though it may sometimes be.
Can I ask you both a question then, which is, yeah. I'm intrigued about, how often do you sort of call on your agents to ask, you know, if there's a project that you're really keen to know about or you haven't heard, do you get your agents to do it? Because I think that seems to have stopped happening as much as it used to. And I think that the part of the problem with that is the increase in email. Because again, when I started, an agent would just ring me a week later and just say, well, what's going on with that audition?
That's interesting, because I didn't know that. I always feel like I'm being a bit of a needy pain in the ass if I follow something up. And I will only follow up things that I thought went really well that I really want to do. And I might say, have you got any news? And you feel like an idiot saying it, because of course they if they did, they'd tell you. But you just want to keep that conversation going and keep that dream alive a bit longer. What about you, Abiola?
Yeah, I would say similarly to yourself, if there's a project that I really, really enjoyed taping for and I want to know, because often what can happen is there's been a halt in production and you are still in the mix, but they're actually just
that lovely phrase, you're still in the mix.
You're still in there. They're navigating the direction. But yeah. No, I think I do think that does come under communication with your rep. I think we have like different states of feeling, and I've definitely had the states where I only want a phone call if I've got a job, because I'm, you know, because it's not, the no's aren't helpful right now at this stage. And if they've come, that's great, and they can park them and keep them. But I will assume from like the dates having passed that I haven't got it, and actually that's enough.
Yeah,
for me,
there's such a thing as too much feedback as well, isn't there? I'm going to point you 100%. To now a really brilliant podcast, and the guy's name's gone out of my head. It's called Dead Eyes. Have you heard of that one, Al? Oh, look it up. It's a brilliant, starts with a small story and then goes down a rabbit hole of actors' neuroses. And it's about a guy who got a small role in a Tom Hanks Band of Brothers. And he went for the costume fitting, and on his way there, he was told, actually, Tom Hanks has seen your tape and he thinks you have dead eyes. So can you actually come and read for him? And this guy thought he had the job. So he goes in, reads for Tom Hanks and sits outside for 10 minutes and comes, and the casting director comes down, kneels down in front of him, which is never a good sign, and says, I'm really sorry, but he's decided to go another way. And this is after he thought he had the job. So this spirals into this long podcast about, you know, he goes into forensic detail asking other actors he's worked with, look in my eyes and what do you see? Do they look dead? And just the whole rejection and massive effect it had on his mental health for years to come. So yeah, look that one up. Al, have you ever told anyone they had dead eyes?
I might have thought it. No.
Is there anything that you have found that is a good way to be honest, but to let people down in a hopeful or a positive way?
Well, I was very, very interested in what we've just been talking about. If you think, I always think about it in terms of, I'm not going to see you just for this one job and then that's the end of the relationship. But, you know, actors' careers are long, strange, wandering lines. And, you know, we're magpies, casting directors. We'll meet somebody for one thing and we will, at the back of a heavy game, they'd be perfect for that other project. And you know, that is genuinely how it works. So I think it's a big process, and you know, I'm always thinking ahead. I've just come from a reading this morning, and you know, there were for a new play that's coming up next year.
Anything for me in it, love?
I'm afraid not.
All actors say that, don't they, all the time? Anything for Abiola?
Anyone? Keep us in the mix.
Yeah, I know that's all. You're now in my mind for two other projects.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. I'm just trying to find the name of the guy who's done this podcast. Anyway, look it up, Dead Eyes. It's really brilliant. Listen, that's all we've got time for, but it's been really lovely to talk to you, Al Kuma from the National Theatre, and Abiola Ogunbiyi from the Equity Women's Committee. And listeners might like to know that Al and me are wearing almost identical stripy T-shirts. But Abiola's flaunting this season's must-have corduroy. Thank you so much. All power to you. Cheers.
Members of the company, the house is now open. The house is now open. Please do not cross the stage. Thank you.
Now, the casting process is at the centre of so much heartache for performers. Access to the opportunity to audition, the preparation time allowed, the amount of work required to prep, the types of roles we get seen for, and of course, that hottest of hot potatoes, who gets to tell the story and play the role. And joining me in the Equity Green Room today is none other than Vice Chair of the LGBT Plus Committee, the wonderful Tigger Blaise. Welcome to the Green Room, Tigger.
Thank you so much. Hi, Jackie. It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
I know. We met recently, didn't we, at the Royal Court doing a workshop of new queer writing, which was really good fun. Now, as Vice Chair of the LGBT Plus Committee, I just want to ask you a little bit first about what sort of challenges and discriminations, why do we have these committees around protected characteristics, around minorities, as they used to be called? Why are these sorts of things necessary in terms of protecting casting processes?
They're necessary because we're still, can you believe it, being discriminated against, sometimes in really small ways, sometimes in sort of micro ways, and sometimes in huge, massive ways. So while there still exists a discrimination and inequality and a playing field which is not level, then these groups are required to kind of be a watchdog, keep an eye on that, help to people to understand more, and maybe to come down a little bit heavier when we need to.
Yeah, and what sort of work, what's on the agenda at the committee? What sort of stuff have you been doing around the casting guide? What does it cover, and what sort of changes do you hope it will make?
Well, yeah, our casting guide was quite a big project for us, which was born out of a motion that we put to the annual representative conference before COVID, seems like a long time ago, and that motion was passed. And so we then embarked on some work, which was about putting together a set of guidelines for the industry around working with LGBT plus performers. And we kind of started that work by getting together 10 performers who identify as LGBT plus, 10 industry professionals, so directors, writers, producers, agents, casting directors, whatever, who would kind of help us to bring up some questions, things that they wanted answered, areas where they maybe didn't understand. And so we got together and we did an interaction with the 20 of us and sort of divided it into separate sections and had a really frank conversation about what, where we as performers and equity members can help the industry to help us, because that's really powerful. And we accumulated a lot of information and we went away and wrote it and came up with the first draft, and it was launched at the National Theatre at an event in October 2019, I believe. And those guidelines are, I would say, a toolkit. So they are a set of practical guidelines that people in the industry can use to help them in their work, whether that's as a stage manager, as a director, as a writer, as a casting director, as a venue. It covers lots of different areas, and it's designed to be proactive. It's certainly not a finger wagging thing, and it's certainly not telling anyone off. It's designed to be useful. I mean, that's the bottom line. And, you know, essentially asking people in the industry to take courage. And even though they might not understand very much about this area, because, you know, it's still a new area to many, taking courage and coming along and meeting professionals, equity members who identify this way is just, you know, great practice and a really good way to start.
So in terms of what that toolkit contained. What sorts of things can help people when they're looking at casting more inclusively in terms of improving mental health in our industry?
Okay, so the guide is essentially divided into a few sort of big chunks. So it's divided into what happens before a casting, what happens during a casting or an audition, and things that you can do after somebody's been cast or you're working with them in a venue or whatever. So some things that you can consider are the actual physical space that you're in. Is it accessible to everyone? Is it safe for, you know, people with protected characteristics can be victims of hate crimes. And, you know, we're in the darker months now where it's, you know, it gets dark really quickly in the afternoon. And so is that venue, you know, is there good lighting and footfall and things like that? And just making sure that, you know, if you're casting people who are out as LGBT plus, then they can easily be a target. So, you know, just making sure your venue is kind of friendly. Also, when people are actually working, you know, they might be working late into the evening on a theatre show. How are they getting home? If they're out as an LGBT person, for example, in a show, how are they getting home? You know, buddies, you can buddy up, taxis, lifts, etc. It just gives really practical advice like that. Things like how to find performers who might have particular protected characteristics, like using hashtags on Twitter. You know, lots of LGBT people have not gone through the traditional routes of drama school, etc. And they're making their own work really successfully, thank you very much, and doing really well in like festivals and cabaret and circus and those kind of areas that aren't sort of considered mainstream. So, you know, it's how to find people, like opening up your mind and opening up your sort of awareness to where you might find them. How to treat people when they're actually in the room, you know, checking basic things like pronouns, maybe finding out how they like to be addressed, he, she, they, or something else, before they arrive, knowing how to ask them if you've forgotten what their pronouns are. There's also a really big glossary at the back, which is, you know, all words that you might think, oh my God, what is that term? What does that mean? And so you can look it up in the glossary at the back. There's so much in there. There's things for stage managers, you know, things like how to maybe be more inclusive in your backstage and front of house calls. So instead of saying things like, ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats for, you might say, good evening, everyone, please take your seats for. And it's such a tiny change. It's such a tiny thing, but it makes a huge difference to somebody like me who, you know, doesn't hear themselves being welcomed to a place when you say ladies and gentlemen, but does when you say everyone. So yeah, it's there's loads in there. It's quite a small pamphlet, but it's packed with really useful things, and the headings are in really useful kind of go-to order, so you can find things really easily in it.
Sounds amazing, and I have looked at it, and it's full of really useful advice, and it's so interesting what you said about, I mean, a lot of the time I think it's unconscious bias, isn't it? People don't even realise that their practices are exclusionary. So, for example, what you just said about finding performers, you know, via alternative means, as you say, I mean, a lot of us came into the industry via the back door, as it were, and very proud of it too. And sometimes just being a bit more creative can really help diversity in the industry, which in turn helps the work that we do, because who doesn't want diverse work? We don't all want to watch the same stuff, do we? Exactly. Same people telling the same stories over and over again. But it is a divisive topic, isn't it? The question of who gets to tell what stories. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit, because this is cause of a lot of mental illness, I suppose, and mental trauma for people with protected characteristics. The fact that, you know, straight people end up playing gay parts, it can be very difficult for queer people to access straight parts because they're told, well, we don't buy that that's a romance between a heterosexual couple because you're clearly gay, whereas it doesn't seem to work the other way around. And you often get straight performers playing gay characters. I know the Deaf and Disabled Committee have talked about actors and this is their expression, cripping up, playing parts that should be played or could be played by disabled actors. And quite often the response is, well, it's very difficult to find people of the right caliber. It's very difficult to find people who have those protected characteristics to play those roles. But, you know, what you've just said is a really practical way of trying to access those people. And I just wanted to ask you, I suppose, a little bit about where you stand on that argument about, you know, some actors will say, well, we're actors, we should be able to play anything. What does Macbeth have to be played by a murderer? You know, and of course, the answer to that is, well, murderers are not sort of marginalized groups, are they? Need more of a platform and deserve the right to tell their own story. This is about punching up, isn't it? This is about wanting greater access for a wider variety of people. Where do you stand on that whole argument, Tigger?
Absolutely. It is a tricky one. So first and foremost, I want to say that one day I truly do believe, and I live in hope, that we will get to a point where there is a level playing field and any actor will be able to play any part. However, we are not there yet. We're just not. And while we're not, we need to punch up, as you say, and kind of, you know, start to really have representation and people with lived experience playing those roles authentically until we get to a point where there is no discrimination and anybody can play anything. I think particularly trans people at the moment are having a really tough time in the media, and every single day there is a story, whether that's, you know, in mainstream media or on social media or whatever, which is awful for trans people. It is treating trans people terribly. And there are statistics that show that while that kind of media goes out, and when there's a kind of heightened amount of that kind of media going out, there is more crime and more hate crime against that particular group of people with those protected characteristics. And, you know, it's a kind of measurable thing. And I think if we're not, if trans people aren't being allowed to tell their stories authentically, then the world is not getting true representation. They're not getting to see what trans people are like, and therefore they're not understanding our experience. And then they see these media depictions and the whole thing just kind of crumbles. I really think we have to start kind of getting to a point of almost zero tolerance. I mean, I imagine there are times when, you know, we can open things up a little bit, but generally there is so much talent out there who, you know, people who identify as LGBT plus, there are trans performers, there are performers who are gender variant, and they are talented and ready to work. And if you're saying you can't find them, then I'm sorry, I don't believe you. You're not looking hard enough.
And not looking in the right places quite often. Yeah. What do you make of Eddie Redmayne, his recent announcement that he made a mistake in playing a trans character?
Yeah, I think it's good that he did that. It is good that he did that. I think, you know, holding your hands up and saying that you've made a mistake is always a good thing, rather than just kind of hiding it and sweeping it under the carpet. I also think, you know, that in sort of history, and not particularly very sort of history going too far back, but not that long ago, we were kind of accepting cis people, that is people that aren't trans, cis people, you know, and cis actors playing those roles. We were kind of accepting that because nobody knew any trans actors, right? There weren't really any, or there were a few, maybe you could count them on the fingers of one hand. And therefore, though, you know, it was kind of more acceptable back then to have people, cis actors playing those trans roles. But it is just not acceptable anymore because we are so out there and so kind of, you know, there's a whole community of us. And so that can't happen now. And just like back in the day, you know, things with people of colour, you know, and how awful it was that white actors took those roles and, you know, even sort of blackface and yellowface and things like that. You just would not do it now, and rightly so. It's kind, we're kind of getting to that point with other protected characteristics as well. So I think although those things happened, we are moving on and we are learning, and that's good. That can only be good.
And I think it's also to do with the stories that are being told now, isn't it? Because the more we open up our culture to a diversity of voices, the more those voices need to be authentic, I think. Because if you're telling the story of, you know, say, for example, Russell T. Davis, It's a Sin, he came out and said, well, I'm not going to cast anyone who isn't queer in queer roles anymore, because I feel that the story deserves that authenticity of that lived experience. And there was some gay, I think I remember Christopher Biggins saying, well, you know, I don't care if a straight person plays a gay character as long as they're a good actor, you know, which is another point of view. And some people would have a lot of sympathy with that. But I think I'm with Russell on this one. I think, you know, that was such a particular time in history, wasn't it? That to use actors who didn't go through that, didn't live that experience of that oppression at that time, or even if they were, you know, too young, like the main character in that series, to have lived through some of those same oppressions would give him license to play that character with a bit more authenticity, I think.
Absolutely. And you get, you know, actors who are straight, who play gay and go on to win awards for that. And, you know, they get all these accolades for being brave and whatnot. And it's
They're brave on camera, but queer people have to live it every day of their lives. Yeah,
exactly. Absolutely. I think it also boils down to writers. You know, if the writers are not LGBT plus, then, you know, what are we seeing there? Well, quite often we're seeing a story through a cis or a straight lens. You know, we're not seeing something that is kind of authentic and written from a trans perspective or an LGB perspective. And sometimes I feel that those stories can be sort of diluted in a way to be sort of palatable for an audience who, let's face it, you know, largely straight and largely cis. And you know, and therefore our stories are not being told by trans people or LGBT people, and they're not being portrayed by people who are, then what have you got? You've just got a kind of cis sort of, in, you know, imitation of something.
And I think that that really matters. It really matters that the lens is correct, because it's a bit like gaslighting a whole community otherwise, isn't it? If we're talking about mental health and protected characteristics, the empowerment that comes from allowing the people that know those stories to tell those stories, either in the writing or the direction or the performance of those roles, it's got to be authentic. Otherwise, you're telling people about themselves when you don't actually know. And that's just a kind of another oppression, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I grew up not seeing myself anywhere in any arts. You know, I didn't see my stories. I didn't see myself. So, you know, I didn't know that I could be, you know, and that's unfortunately how it is for lots of people. And I think
if you can't see it, you can't be it. That's what they say, isn't
it? Yeah, it's exactly that. And I think if you're allowing cis male actors to go on and play trans female characters, then you're kind of putting out just the wrong signal. You're putting out a signal which says, you see, it's just a deception. It's just a costume. We can just put it on and therefore be a different gender. And for trans people, it's not like that. You know, it is, there is no choice. This is how we feel, and this is how we are. And it's not a case of, oh, I can just do this and be another gender.
Fantastic. And finally, Tigger, I just wanted to ask you, what's going well? What are we achieving on? How are we helping the mental health of LGBT performers? What are we getting right?
I think we are speaking up more. We're more visible, and therefore people are starting to be curious and want to understand more. I also think there's a lot of people out there who maybe they don't understand, but they want to, and they want to get it right. And therefore they're really keen to ask for help and to check with us. Like, you know, we get a lot of emails onto the committee saying, we're doing this show, we're not sure about this, can you help us, can you give us some advice on this? And so, you know, people are starting to reach out. And the fact that I think that's because we are visible and we're not afraid to kind of be seen. So I think that's going really well. And I think just, you know, the fact that we're a great network and there are places for people to go for help. If they're, you know, if they're struggling with discrimination at work or mental health, there are more resources.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for all your very powerful activism. Is there a role, finally, that you would love to play?
Oh, do you know, I think I'm playing it at the moment. I'm playing Passepartout in Around the World in 80 Days. And it is just in Guernsey. Yeah. And it is just, it's just so fun. It's really physical. And I'm playing him as a cis man. And that is that right now, that feels just where I need to be.
Fantastic. Tigger Blaze, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
Miss Clune, there is a guest for you at stage door. There is a guest waiting for you at stage door. Thank you.